Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Art of Tracking Radio Show. Tracking is still alive and well. Join us as we interview master trackers from around the world. We'll hear their stories, their secrets. So tune in and enjoy all you hear. Welcome.
Hello, today we have Joe Lau, a former instructor at Tracker School. He still lives in New Jersey, and he is an RN now, and he has so much to tell us, and I really can't wait, because Joe is one of my heroes. So, Joe, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
How's it going? Yeah.
It's going great. So,
good. I've studied and read your stuff and watch your videos, and I know you have passions for healing and caretaking, and we have a lot of stuff to talk about, but I hope you can get to that as well, Joe.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
Could you start with just a basic background on yourself, sir?
Sure. The pertinent things really are probably what led me to this lifestyle. And when I was a kid, I had very, very bad life-threatening asthma. I would end up in the hospital every year in ICU, and it was always give and take. And this went on most of my childhood, so it wasn't a very fun childhood. My father was asthmatic, so I kind of inherited my asthma from him. And so growing up, I kind of had a lot of thoughts about life and death. And it kind of led me to where I am today. That was kind of the beginning. But real quickly, my parents passed away. And so I was kind of on my own. And I became a jack of all trades. And this kind of yearning for, like, trying to understand life and death, I developed a path toward martial arts and nature skills. So eventually these led me to the martial art that I studied today, the Bujinkan, which is in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and to the Tracker School. I was in Scouts, and I would go to the library and get nature books. And one day I came across Tracker and Search in hardcover when I was like 11 or 12 or something like that. I was young.
Yeah.
And I was very excited about it. I started reading it right away. I kept taking it in and out of the library. But eventually a friend told me, like you had just told me, that there was a field guide to Wilderness Survival by Tom Brown. I didn't even know about it. And I didn't even realize it, but in the back of the books, there was a thing for a school. And yeah. I'm like, oh, well, as soon as I was of age, you know, I signed up. So, and the funny thing is that I kind of snuck in there when I was really young. I was like 17. So I had literally just gotten my driver's license and then drove out to the school.
Wow.
So I was very excited, and it was a great experience. I learned a lot. And so what else can I tell you? So I did a lot of classes over the years, being a jack of all trades. I did a whole bunch of jobs. I just did martial arts and wilderness skills. And I didn't go to college. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But after a couple of years, in 1996, Richard Cleveland, who was the senior instructor at the time,
yes.
I guess he needed a new instructor, so they I guess my name got batted around, and I got hired. I got hired in the spring of '96.
Wow!
And it was like a dream come true. I'll tell you, it was like I can't describe the feeling. And the next year there was a strange people just. You don't stay there long because you got to follow your own path in life. So, you know, it's you don't stay too long at Tracker because things lead you elsewhere. And there was kind of a turnover the next year, and I was last man standing, which put me in an odd position. So I was senior instructor because I knew all the logistics of the school. I knew everything that needed to be done to run the school. And when the new guys came in, which was like Brian and Dan Stanchfield and Roseanne. So we had a good crew. And over the years, we had more good crew come in. You know, we had Eddie Starnader and Tom McElroy and, you know, and a bunch of other people, all good people. And
yes,
pleasure to work with. Yeah, and also at that time, Kevin Reeve came on as director. And he did a lot of good things with the school, too. And we were a pretty good team. We loved working together. We kind of learned each other's flow. It was nice. We worked with Tom's flow. And we were excited to give back what we got. You know, it's like that where you want those people to experience the same things that you were experiencing when you were learning, like, you know, getting their first coal or,
exactly.
You know, burning a bowl, you know, your first debris hunt, all those things, you know, making your first traps. It's an amazing experience. And we were excited to be part of that lineage, that legacy. It was a very exciting time. But eventually, you know, I started to find my own path, and I realized that I wanted to go into nursing. So in 2001, I started nursing school, and because I wanted to be an ER nurse. I only wanted to do ER. And so I did that for 4 years, and I instead of being out in the field as an instructor, I used what I knew to kind of help out in the office. So I was an assistant office manager along with the folks that worked there. My wife, by the way, she was office manager, Raquel. She was office manager at the time, so it was kind of nice working with my wife.
Yeah.
And so it was convenient. And the thing is that when I was out in the field all those years, we were away for weeks on end, so it was a strain, but this kind of helped things a little bit. Anyway, so I did 4 years of nursing school, and then in 2005, I got my first job as an ER nurse, and I've been a nurse ever since 2005.
Wow.
It's been a good journey. Yeah, it's been a good journey. That's the quick version of it.
All right, so I know one thing for sure. I think one of your favorite skills is primitive fire.
Yes, absolutely.
And it seems like you have mastered all of that.
Well, I wouldn't say that about myself, but when I would teach the standard course, well, first let me say this: after you've been teaching all of these things for a number of years, you kind of realize what your niches are, like where you like. Well, I really kind of like doing that skill more than I like doing that skill, and you just kind of fall into that over the years. There's things you just find yourself doing or wanting to do more. And eventually at a standard class, I would say my three favorite skills are primitive cooking, stone tools, and friction fire. And I would say that because I really like to eat, and I can't eat until I have stone tools to make a fire. And I said, like, I'm all set. So which was kind of nice, because it shows the interrelationship of skills that you can't, some skills you just can't do without other skills. If you don't have a knife, you're not carving instruments for a fire. That's just not happening.
Right.
So there's no other way to carve wood without a knife than to do with, unless you have stone. So I became really good at those things. Stone was, at least at that time, stone was really my main addiction. Like I almost needed a 12-step program for working stone.
Well, I know what you mean. I've been at stone work for a long time, and It's tricky and it's very addictive, and you know, I think any flint napper, you know, gets used to getting cut to where it doesn't even bother them. You know, you're all blood and people are freaking out and you don't even notice it.
That's right. You're sitting in the pool of blood. You're just like, ah, oh, just walk it off. But I would do, you know, the guys, we would just sit around, and the girls too, Ruth Ann was into it too. We would sit around, Ed Starnader, Billy McConnell, and Richard Cleveland. We loved flint napping. We would just sit around in the pit and just hit rocks for like hours. And, over the years, actually, since 2010, I kind of started Fire Dojo, and I just said to myself, you know what, I'm going to do every single kind of fire there is that I could find from around the world. Like, I'm just going to get it done, and I'm just going to see how many ways I can do it with as many materials as I can do it, and then it kind of took off from there. So I as much as I could figure, there's mainly 8 basics that you will see as a method around the world: hand drill, mouth drill, bow drill, pump drill. I call it a toggle drill, but some people call it the Eskimo strap drill. And then you have those are the main drill ones. And then you have the 3 main, what I call linears. The linears go back and forth in kind of a straight line. That's the fire plow, the fire saw, and the fire thong. So you have basically those 8 when you get down to it as a method. And there's variations off those. And then I discovered that there's one lost technique that no one really sees and no one really knows about. And the only name that I found for it was the fire drill of the gauchos. And if you know what a carpenter's brace is, you know how the old-timey carpenters used to drill a hole? Yeah, that's basically how you do a fire. You got to find a
curved
stick. That's a curved stick shaped like a carpenter's brace, and you just make a fire like that. And it does work.
Wow.
Yeah. So
well, that's
it's
very
amazing.
Inspiring. Very inspiring how you've taken that on. And, you know, there's a lot of us out there that work primitive skills and might get a bow drill fire a couple times and then, you know, set it up and say, I got that. But to, you know, to take it on as a lifetime goal and to just master it or work at it and figure out everything that'll work, that's inspiring.
Well, my main inspiration that brought me to that was my martial arts, actually. I don't know how familiar or if you're familiar with the Bujinkan, the martial art we do.
Not very.
Okay, so it's, how do I say it? It's the most well-known ninja art out there. And it's under this guy named Hatsumi Soke in Japan. And it's the Bujinkan, which in Japanese means the training hall of the warrior spirits, is actually 9 old Japanese warrior lineages brought down to 1.
Wow.
Because this guy teaches 9 schools of lineages, and he just named, instead of saying 9 different names, he created the Bujinkan Dojo. So, and each one has its own specialty. So one is like in armor with the big battlefield weapons. One was a lot of groundwork. One was a lot of striking. So each one had its own kind of quirks. But it was all
joint manipulation.
Throwing, kicking, a lot of weapons. And the training method in the Bujinkan is that there is a kind of a starting technique, like in a scroll or something. And we call that a waza. Some people call it a kata. And we'll work on that for a few minutes. And then we just see where that will go. We do variations off variations off variations off variations. And all of a sudden, the technique almost doesn't seem to look like the technique anymore. But if you look closely, you can still see the beginnings of it in there.
Wow.
So that was really my inspiration for how to start doing the fire. Because it's like, okay, you have to, and here's what I kind of, well, humans are kind of creatures of habit, you know, it's like, and when some people will, like, bust out their bow drill or hand drill or something like that, they'll bust out what they know. They're like, I know I could do a mullet, I know I could do a horseweed, or, you know, or I'm going to do my cedar bow drill. And that's fine, because, you know, it's like, friction is there, you want to do it, you know, you want to, it brings you back to that feeling and everything like that. But you have to push yourself beyond your comfort limits if you really want to grow. So, and I just, that's where I found my excitement, was in the place where I was uncomfortable in order to get to another level. And
exactly.
But this is a tracking show. So, I'm going to be completely intellectually honest with you. I am probably going to be the worst dirt tracker on your show, because tracking in itself was never my forte. Like, I liked, and when I was a kid, I really liked it. I couldn't stop looking at the ground. You know, I studied all the animal tracks. I did all the measurements. I had a tracking stick. I was, you know, just as obsessed as everyone else when you're young and you're really into it.
But yeah,
tracking never became my forte. It never became my thing. So, and with other instructors, that was their forte. That was their thing to do. They really loved it. They ate it up, and that was fine. And as a team, we really balanced each other out. But I'm
right,
not
right,
really
yeah.
my tracking skills are not the greatest. So, I mean, if it's a pretty good trail, I could do my best to follow it, and have an idea about it. But what a lot of people will discuss on your show is that how do you get better? How do you grow? You have to put yourself in situations where the terrain is harder to read in material that is harder to read, like pine needles or over rocks, or like, how do you push those skills? You have to make yourself uncomfortable, and that's what I wanted to do with fire.
That's awesome.
So I'll stop there for a second.
No, that's great.
Okay.
You were talking, when we talked, you were mentioning the protector side of things.
Yes. So this goes back to me being as a sick child and really wanting to understand about life and death. I mean, I really felt I was really like a different kid from all other kids. Like I couldn't explain it. I didn't have words for it. I didn't run into anyone else that, as far as I know, had the same feeling. But I always felt like there was something more important than all the superficial things that I saw around me as a child. I couldn't put my finger on it. So like I had said, this kind of put me on the path toward martial arts and wilderness survival. Not even just nature, but like wilderness survival. What really led me toward wilderness skills, because I had started off liking nature. You know, I was the kid in the creek looking for crayfish, turning over rocks. You know, what plant is that? You know, I was that kid in the woods. I wasn't the kid, just playing kickball or playing manhunt or whatever. And I loved to be outside and in nature. But when I came across tracker and search. Then I had touched on something that where nature actually met Mother Nature met human nature. So, like, and I've 2 years ago I had an interview with Ricardo Sierra. Ricardo Sierra was on your show, and he had this thing called the Wolverine Way. We were talking about you know, trying to get kids interested in nature stuff, and so the thing is that I had mentioned to him at that time that, you know, there'll be these nature programs you'll go to where this is a certain kind of oak tree, this is a you know, a jack-in-the-pulpit plant, and, you know, this is some kind of bamboo. And all of that is really nice, you know, learning these things about nature. But there's no connection between what that means to be a human being and nature. And when I discovered wilderness survival skills, that brought nature and what it meant to be human, a human being, as a matter of life and death together. Now I had a path toward what being in nature actually meant to me, because it turned it into the visceral thing that I was looking for. Like, I recognized this tree. It's a box elder tree, and I know that it is a tree that is good for fire making. So now it's not just a box elder. It's a box elder that it's a tree that's going to save my life. Or actually, to go farther with that, it's the tree that will save my family's life, my tribe's life. So every skill that I started to learn, every skill that I started to focus on, it came with the perspective that this is the way, which is why everything that I do is called dojo. Dojo means place of the way. This is the way to save life. So when I did my martial arts, this is the way of protecting and defending life. And in wilderness skills, this is the way of providing and sustaining life. And I had realized that during my years of being a tracker, I was missing an element. And I realized this because at one point in our instructorship, we had to be EMT trained, wilderness EMT trained. And so we went through this course, and I all of a sudden it hit me what I was really missing. I was missing the role of the healer, the preserver of life. Now, my father was a cardiologist before he passed away, and I had thought that I had never wanted to go into the medical field because, you know, he was a doctor. He had a doctor's lifestyle, and I think that was one of the things that kind of put him in the grave. And so I was, you know, in the back of my mind, in my subconscious, I didn't want to do that. But then I realized that this is the way of saving life.
Right.
So I had skills under my belt where I could provide and sustain life. I had skills sort of under my belt where I could protect and defend, but I didn't have the skills to preserve and save life. And so I made the decision that I was going into nursing school. Actually, I wasn't going to go into nursing school. I was going to be a paramedic because I thought that was going to be more. I thought that was going to be more exciting, but there were two nurses at one of the courses, and so one was, I can't remember his name, I think it was Wayne, and this other guy, Larry, and I'm still Facebook friends with Larry, and he's an old-time tracker, he's been around for like forever, and these guys sat me down. You don't want to be a paramedic, you want to be a nurse. They go, trust us on this. You don't want to do that. He goes, if you become a nurse, you could go into any field and, you know, you'll always have work and you'll increase your skills in any field you decide to go into, but just by switching. But you don't want to be a paramedic. You want to be a nurse. And, you know, that was really good advice. And because one of the things that was keeping me from doing that was the stigma of being a guy. Like, you know, I didn't want to be the male nurse.
Right.
But let me tell you, to all you guys out there, this is one of the best temp secrets. Because guys like to fix things. So if you could fix people, if you think you could fix people, you want to be a nurse. I mean, it's one of the best vocations you can ever go into, so I kind of want to do a shout-out with that. Now, nursing school,
wow.
I would not wish on my worst enemy. But when you're done, it will have been worth it. But it's a big sacrifice, nursing school. I'll tell you, four years of your life and you. But that's how I kind of figured that out. Now I call these roles the actually there's four roles. There's the profiler, which is the scout. The provider,
yes,
or the hunter-gatherer. In traditional terms, it'd be the hunter-gatherer. The protector, who in traditional terms would be the warrior, and the preserver, who in traditional terms is the healer. So I had been thinking about these terms while I was working at the tracker, and I realized that was severely lacking in the preserver healer department, so I needed to round out that skill. So, but this is a tracking show again, so a lot of what I wanted to talk about today was the scout, because tracking falls under the realm of the scout, and to me the scout is the information gatherer, the problem solver, and through the years as I studied my skills, I came to realize that the scout was the most important role out of all of them. And I tried to test this. I'm like, well, if there had to be a triage or like a hierarchy of how you have to do this, I came to realize that you cannot be a hunter-gatherer or a provider for your tribe, unless you know where everything is. Like if you need dumping quarters, you have to know where that is. You have to know what to do with it. All of that is in the realm of the scout. When you have to protect and defend your tribe, the first thing you have to know is where the enemy is, what they're going to do, what's their potential, how are you going to set up to defend your tribe or yourself? All of that is information, and all of that is in the realm of the scout. Now, then it came to the healer or the preserver of life. Now, this again, the first thing you must do if you're going to help somebody is you need to assess and diagnose them. You have to get a medical history. You have to find out how they're feeling, what's wrong with them, what medicines they're taking, what happened before this. You have to gather as much information as you possibly can before you can even decide what to do to help this person.
Right.
So to me, the hunter-gatherer, the warrior, the healer, they all fall under the umbrella of the scout in order to be a good hunter-gatherer, a good warrior, a good healer, and a good tracker.
It sounds like it's all tracking, you know, even if you're trying to diagnose, it's tracking.
So, again, I'm going to honestly admit, I am the worst dirt tracker you're ever going to have on your show. But I have come to settle this with myself in that tracking is our first language, and you may or may not have heard this before with other trackers, but tracking is our first language. And I actually realized this when I was in nursing school, when we had to study anatomy and physiology. Now, anatomy physiology simply means structure and function, right? So if I have a heart or a kidney, specific structure, that organ, has a specific function, right? You cannot switch out a kidney for a heart, and you can't switch out a liver for a brain. They have specific functions according to what their structure, what they do. Well, just about all life on this planet understands their environment because of structure and function. Like a squirrel can see a tree and know that it can go up it and have a home in it and a dog that's running through the woods knows that it can't run through a tree, right? So it understands that what it sees is also what it kind of does. So in actually at the tracker school, there's kind of a saying when they're doing tracking, and it's what is this? But there's a second part of that, what does this mean? And I realized that in nursing school because we kind of have the same thing, assessment and diagnosis. Assessment is gathering your facts or your information. But that's just gathering them up into a big pile. Diagnosis is putting it together into a pattern so that it actually means something to you. So when we look at things, no matter what it is, we have to try to associate a meaning to it. Like right now I'm in my basement and I'm looking at a piece of fabric and I can tell by its structure it's my son's tie that he wears when we go out to a certain event. And it's like, well, it's among a whole bunch of other fabrics, but its structure tells me its function from his T-shirt or this blanket or this towel. They all have different functions. Their structures are similar. They're made of fabrics. Okay, but this is how we move through life. And to me, even if we can't speak the same language, this as not just human beings, but animals, this is our first language. And I think as we evolve from animals to primates to who we are today, this came along with us and we just developed word language in order to communicate better what it is that we already know. When we can see something, hear something, feel something, like what this is a structure and what does it mean? Structure and function.
That's actually pretty deep stuff right there, Joe. That's awesome.
Well, I'll tell you,
that's awesome.
my whole thing is really just, is it a matter of life and death? Because if it's not, I don't care. And I'm not trying to sound like I don't care about anything else or any other kind of problem. But I'm like, I kind of developed this new personality after I became an ER nurse, and after all my training with the wilderness skills and in martial arts, and it's just like, if it's not life threatening, it's just details. It's really just details, and you could relax through life, you know, just keep growing as a person. Until you have to put that on hold and deal with the serious issues that need to be dealt with. So that's kind of my take on things. But like I was talking about this combination of bringing together Mother Nature and human nature. And that was a big realization for me, because I had also realized that there's three kinds of nature. There's the nature that we all kind of know, which is the planet we live on, and it's life-sustaining, and there's like millions and millions and millions of different other kinds of life that we share on this planet, right? We share it with the grass and the trees and the animals and even bacteria and the plankton in the sea. But there's also 7 billion humans on this planet. And but here's the thing. One day you're going to turn on the news, and there's, every once in a while, there's a seriously tragic event that takes out 100,000 people. And, like, what does that? What takes out 100,000 lives? Let's take, for example, the Japanese tsunami. The other tsunami. I think it was in Thailand. Or was it Thailand or something like that? And it just wipes out like tens of thousands of people. Well, there's another kind of nature going on, and that's just nature. And, you know, we live on a planet that goes around the sun, and we're in a solar system. The solar system goes around our Milky Way galaxy, and we are just one galaxy, billions of galaxies. I mean, you can go out exponentially. I mean, it would take 15 billion years at the speed of light to get to the edge of our known universe.
Right.
But even by the time you got there, it will have gone out another 15 billion years at the speed of light. But, you know.
I know. And it's insane.
Right? It's insane, right? But the thing is that most of the universe has nothing to do with us. Because human beings are anthropocentric. Like, we focus on being human and what it is to be human and the human experience and the human condition. And that's why people like us try to focus on preserving Mother Nature and this whole thing about climate change and how destroying the environment is going to destroy ourselves, because people have lost this connection. Because people are too anthropocentric. People are too focused on being just human and not our relationship to everything else. Well, we can't forget our relationship that we're swinging around the sun, swinging around the galaxy. There are forces that have nothing to do with us that control everything on this planet. So when the crust shifts and throws up a wave 50 feet high and drowns 100,000 people, we all of a sudden quickly remember that there's a serious nature that even overrides Mother Nature, and that Mother Nature itself is a fragile thing. 65 million years ago, an asteroid came down and wiped out a planet of dinosaurs, right? So, as far as we know. So I mean, there's a big crater off of Guatemala that's supposed to be that took out the dinosaurs. But it's like change of an entire planet can happen at whatever is happening with nature, meaning the universe. But we bring that concentric ring just down to us, just down to human. So if you can imagine a ring 15 billion light years around, nature. That's nature.
Yeah.
Now imagine a ring the size of the Earth. Well, that's just Mother Nature. That's what we brought Mother Nature down to. And then you have 7 billion spheres on that planet, which are human beings. And to me, those are my three natures. Nature, Mother Nature, human nature. So again, this is a tracking show. So what I want to do is bring this down to pushing your growth, and whatever you choose, you're still to be. So if it's dirt tracking, that's great. I've listened to some of your shows, and some people had some great things. But here's how I want to bring a perspective to your show, to the listeners out there.
Okay.
I have three things called the three frenemies. frenemy is a new term, right? Friend, enemy, frenemy.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so these three terms comes from probably one of the best known trackers in the world, even though he's a fictional character, Sherlock Holmes.
Oh yeah, and Sherlock is a book.
Right? The greatest detective on the planet. Unfortunately, he's not real.
Right.
So,
but,
if only he was real.
His writer was. Yeah.
Right. So, the three main stories from Sherlock Holmes is The Professor, The Woman, and The Hound. So, The Professor, The Woman, and The Hound. Now, I'm referring to, when it comes to The Professor, his greatest enemy, Professor Moriarty, right?
Yep.
His archenemy. Then you have The Woman, and just to clarify something out there to all our listeners, I'm not being sexist, okay? That's how Sherlock referred to Irene Adler, Irene Adler, right? So she was called The Woman, and so I'm not being facetious or anything. So Irene Adler was the only one, I think, to have ever outsmarted Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
In all his cases. And then there's The Hound, which is, of course, the Hound of the Baskerville. So, why do I refer to these three stories? Well, let's start with The Hound. The Hound represents, and again, this all comes back to my childhood of, like, things of life and death. The Hound represents something of nature that is actually trying to harm you or kill you. So I could reference this in my own life in that the hound, for me, was my asthma. It's a natural thing. It's just something that I'm genetically born into. There's nothing I can do about it. But it's something that is my way of natural selection is trying to take me out. And it almost took me out as a child. Okay? But it holds no grudge against me. Right, natural selection does not hate some people or some animals and tries to take them out. Natural selection is just if you can fit into the pattern, right? Because it's survival of the fittest, which a lot of people misunderstand survival of the fittest to mean the strongest or the fastest, or that's not what that means. Survival of the fittest means you fit into the environment. Or how you adapt into the environment. So if you can't adapt and reproduce, your species will die out.
Right.
So the hound, there may or may not be something in your life that nature has pitted against you. There's something that nature has pitted against you that is your conflict, your struggle, in order for your lineage, your bloodline, to keep reproducing.
Right.
And for me, it's asthma. I mean, it almost took me out how many times in my life. But
actually, I have really, really bad asthma, too. Yep.
Oh, we should talk, because I also became a certified asthma educator. And I completely fixed my asthma. In that I haven't had to. There was a time when I would, you know, a nebulizer, right? You know that thing you have to suck on for like 20 minutes, right? I used to take that twice a day.
Yeah.
And I needed it too. If I didn't take it, and it was a horrible life. I mean, every 12 hours, I had.
Yeah,
to
I'm
going to
start.
To
I'm going to start coughing just thinking about it.
Right. I know it's so visceral, and. But I became a certified asthma educator just so I could find out, because I have to be a scout. I have to gather the information and solve this problem in order to save life. In this case, it's my life. But now I've figured out that problem. I can save other people's lives.
Awesome.
So
that is awesome.
I'm going to tell you what the trick is right now. Asthma, and if it's real, true asthma. The problem is chronic inflammation.
Yeah.
once you focus on the fact that it is a constant case of inflammation in your lungs, remove the environment of inflammation, you are no longer asthmatic.
That is very true.
So in today's day and age, that's a inhaled steroid. So I'm not advertising for any kind of pharmaceutical company or a particular kind of medicine, but you know, I use the purple discus, you know, the Advair.
I don't use the powder. I use Advair, but not the powder.
You use Advair, but not the powder.
Yeah, the Advair discus is a powder. I use an inhaler.
Right, right. So I got you what you're saying. And and if you ever since I started taking care of the inflammation, I've pretty much forgotten what it's like to be a serious asthmatic, where I would literally be afraid to go outside.
Oh yeah,
there
just
were times,
constantly dying. Yeah.
Right. There are times when you think you'd just be sitting there and you can't even breathe. That was the feeling of what it was like for me as a child.
Me too.
Like,
I'd just pass out.
I couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
You can't go anywhere
without
being afraid. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Your body's starving for oxygen. For nothing that you have done. This is just nature in itself.
It is. We are down to 4 minutes, sir. That's the hound. Yeah, 4 minutes, and we're at an hour.
Okay.
So the hound is something trying to take you out.
Well, so nature, not trying to, but it's not like it's trying to, but it's there. If you don't balance the scales, that's on you. This is the reason for the scout. You have to balance the scales to put nature, the environment, back in your favor. So there's
that
problem.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Okay.
Then the
professor.
Woman.
No, let's do the professor. The professor Moriarty.
This is
another human being. This is Sherlock's arch enemy. This is another human being who is out to get you. This is purposeful. This person has a plan, right? This person is doing everything they can to destroy you. Okay, so one way or another. Now we're in the realm of like the real scout. Because when I was teaching down at the scout class down in Tracker School, I would always ask people, why are you at this class? What is this? Why do you come to this class as opposed to just a wilderness skills class? Or an awareness class, or a philosophy class, or a tracking class. Why come to the scout class? The scout class is how you learn the skills of how to deal with other human beings in nature.
Oh yeah, true.
But of course, we're talking about real world situations, right? The professor is where you have to do your information gathering and your problem solving, because another human being has it in for you. So, and that's a serious thing, because that's a life-threatening thing. So the hound and the professor are serious things that you have to deal with. One is nature, one is mother nature, one is human nature. Now, the woman for me is Fire Dojo, for example. The woman is not a serious life-threatening case. Now, in the case of Irene Adler, at least in the story, that was not a life-threatening case. It was one of those cases that Sherlock took on because it interested him, and it was a challenge. Sherlock Holmes liked a challenge.
Yes.
So most of the practice that we'll do is going to be kind of under the guise of the woman. It's going to be something that you have to find challenging that's going to help you grow, because you're going to want to gather the information on as the scout, as the tracker. You want to gather information on that and solve that problem. And that's what's going to help you grow. But you're not under the same pressure as where you're going to die or other people are going to die. So that was what happened with Fire Dojo with me. That was my. Not,
that's.
I know I'm married, so I don't want to say it's the other woman, but. It's,
right. That's an excellent analogy of this Sherlock Holmes. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I watch all those shows. The one on BBC, and I watch Elementary, and I love. I there's nothing like a mystery. There's nothing like once the scout is in your blood. There's nothing like trying to figure out how to solve a problem.
Right.
I tell my son all the time. I go, think of every single game you can think of. Doesn't matter what it is, Monopoly, video game, any game you could possibly play. Every single game you could think of is you're having fun solving a problem. There's some kind of problem that you need to solve. So basically, for recreation, we solve problems. Doesn't matter what it is. Crossword puzzles, Sudoku, everything is a problem. And we do this for recreation. It's in our blood. This is who we are as human beings. We can't help ourselves. We'll be bored to death and like, okay, I'm gonna pick up this crossword puzzle because I need to solve a problem.
Right.
So for all you folks that are listening out there, your Sudoku is tracking. You have to go outside and figure out what this track is. Like, what are they doing? Which way are they looking? What are they looking for? Right. Gather
yeah, sure.
that information, solve that problem. It's, you know, so.
That's interesting. That we're down to a few minutes, and we talked about the Protector, and we talked about Scouts. We talked about Fire Dojo. I love that Sherlock analogy, by the way. We actually did a show about Sherlock Holmes. But
did you?
Yes. Yes, sir. Is there anything else you can think of that you might want to talk about?
Well, I got a few things. We could discuss the seven honors of the Scouts, which is something I learned at Tracker. There's some cases at Tracker. I wasn't really involved in much of them, but we'll do seven honors of the Scouts.
Tracker case.
Well, there was an actual tracker case. Well, you know what? I'll go over the one single tracker case that I was on. So we're down in the Pine Barrens teaching a course, and one day the local police go over to Tom Brown and they want help on a break-in. So I don't know if you've ever been down in South Jersey. The entire southern portion of New Jersey is sand because millions of years it was underwater. And, you know, back and forth as the ocean goes in and goes back out over the millions of years,
yes.
The southern part of New Jersey goes underwater. So it's all sand. So all these houses that are in the area down there, they're all built on sand. So in this one house that was in the backwoods, some young punk broke into somebody's house and stole a couple things from out of the house. And the funny thing is that the entire front of the house, the driveway of the house, everything around the house is open up with sand. You couldn't ask for a better case where the thief left a trail. He literally walked from the road. You can see he walked from the road down the driveway, which is all sand, in boots, right? In the boots, in his boots, to the house. It shows where he went around the house, where he went in the house, where he came out of the house. You couldn't ask for a better. I mean, it was like given to you.
Right.
So, I wasn't really working this case. Dan Stanchfield and Tom McElroy were on this case. And let me tell you, they did the due diligence. They did all the measurements. They did straddle, the actual boot print measurements. They did every single kind of measurement there was possible to do on these things. Inner gate, everything. So if they had to pick this guy out, there was not going to be a problem. They would have. If they had to match tracks with this guy, there was not going to be an issue, right?
Uh-huh.
So they even the cop, I think he was actually holding the guy who they thought was responsible, because later the same guy walked past the crime area, and the owner of the house said, "He has my boots."
And they were wearing their boots.
And the cop, yeah, and the cop took him in. So, and
wow.
They, and now the area around the cop's station is also sand. So they raked out a section of sand, and they made him walk through the sand. And then Dan Stanfield and Tom McElroy took measurements of his thing. Now, I would have said that, you know, his measurements would have been a little different from when he was not being watched.
Right.
So I would say that would definitely be off. But so I'm not really doing anything. I'm really just hanging out. So I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to say I was even really involved in this whole thing. I'm just basically watching Dan and Tom. I'm basically watching Dan and Tom work. Like, do their thing. So we, the cop called us into the station, and I just kind of go along with them. And he sits us down, and he holds up two different boots. Okay? And we're looking at the sole of these two boots. They're two different pairs of boots. Our guy's boots. And I go, it's that one.
No.
Because Dan and Tom were so busy taking measurements of, like, stride, straddle, gait, everything like that. I don't think they had actually looked at the shape of what the boot was inside the track. And while I was just wandering around, I was kind of memorizing the pattern of the boots. And I wasn't even doing measurements. I was just looking at the boot prints in the sand. So when he holds up the boots, I go, well, it's that one. And the cop goes, all right, we got him.
Wow.
And Dan and Tom are like, what? So there's, let me tell you, if it came down to measurements, I would not have known. Like, if there was a wet, like, and that was just a fluke. That's just a complete fluke. But they would have figured out without me there anyway. They would have just went back outside and looked and matched it. But
that is my only
claim to fame. So
that's awesome, Joe. So. We are actually out of time, sir.
Okay.
I really appreciate you having an interview with us, and we will definitely have you on again, okay, sir?
Oh, please. It's been a pleasure. It was great talking with you and everyone out there.
Yes, sir, Joe. You have a good one. I want to thank Joe Lau for being on the Tracker Radio Show, and we will have him on again. Thank you, everybody.
Awesome. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.